Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. It is my absolute privilege to introduce you to a new guest. We're very excited to have him on, Dr. Jakob Nordengard, from coming from Stockholm, Sweden. I had the pleasure of meeting him when I was just in Stockholm. And I just want to tell the story because I have a wonderful ally in Stockholm and I was on my way to visit him. And every time he talks about you, he says, "This guy's research is so," and then he stops and makes it slower, "fantastic." And he's a huge fan. Anyway, so I got a chance to meet you and your lovely wife at dinner in Stockholm. And then, of course, you came to Malmo and gave a great speech in Malmo, Sweden. And anyway, and so we decided that, among other things, I would be able to get an advanced copy. I'd read Rockefeller, your wonderful book, which is in English, and then an advanced copy of your new book, Global Coup, which is sensational. And I was just saying to you, you know, every time you think a book is great, you get to the end, and then in your books, you go into the appendix and you realize, oh, wait, no, it gets even better. Anyway, so I have one great ally who says you can judge a man by his footnotes, at which point you clearly get a Nobel Prize. So anyway, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Salieri Report. And I just have to adjust my screen. My screen's behaving funny. So welcome to Salieri Report. And you know, the best way to introduce you, because you have such a rich resume, you have a very impressive academic history and career with two masters and a PhD from Swedish universities, but you're also got a fabulous music band and you're a composer, and you've created now your own foundation where we can find your books and other materials, and you are clearly a successful author and writer. So I would just say you are a Renaissance man, a man of many seasons. Is that fair?
Yeah, thank you very much.
But one thing I will say is the quality and detail of your research is phenomenal. And it's so important to me to introduce you to the Salieri audience because there are many people who are reluctant to believe that what I would refer to as an op like climate change is as ridiculous as it is. But it's only when you go back and you show the decades that have gone into building up climate change and using weaponizing the environment or developing technocracy, and you see all the work and efforts that's been poured into building this, you realize, oh, this is really true. So the quality of your research really does give a very rich background to what is going on now. And so I'm really thrilled that you're making it available through to the English speaking audience. So let's just start with the two most recent books, Rockefeller and the Global Coup. Talk about how you came to write the book about the Rockefeller family and the Rockefeller family and their work through the generations.
Yes, that's it started actually as I think it was in 2009. I had started my PhD doctoral studies. Mm-hmm. I was about to write a background chapter on how the climate issue, how it had evolved, where did it come from? Because I didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And as I started this, I was supposed to write about 5 pages or something. But, and then I found so much intriguing things in this, and it went back so long in the 50s, and I found these foundations, Rockefeller Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and a couple other foundations like Ford Foundation that right. were very, very much involved in this. And that intrigued me a lot because, I mean, the Rockefellers, hey, these are the old oil men. So why do they involve themselves in climate science and also climate science that blames everything on humans and the burning of fossil fuels? didn't make sense. So that started a process, and I wrote a chapter in my doctoral thesis. And after that, I wanted to know more because my doctoral thesis was about the European biofuel policy.
Uh-huh.
And, the climate change thing was just a side issue. So I wanted to do a deeper research, and I wanted to know more thoroughly why do this family, this foundation get involved in this.
Right.
So
and I just have to hold up the book. Can you see it?
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's amazingly detailed, and, you know, I love great chronologies and great charts. And you've got a lot of detail that shows not only where they started with this, but how they evolved it and invested in it for many, many decades. This has been a long time coming.
Yeah, very long. I mean, that's interesting because, I mean, when you ask people, when did this thing with the climate start? When did they start to talk about human intervention and how humans interfered with the climate? Most people, they talk about Al Gore. And there are more older people, they might say, in the 80s something.
Right.
But then almost nobody know about this prehistory and that it went back to the 50s.
So we'll get back to climate change and carbon, but then you go on. So you publish Rockefeller in 2019, but then you go on to the global coup.
Yeah.
And your new book is called The Global Coup d'Etat. And I keep bugging you for the last, ever since I was in Stockholm, when can I read it? When can I read it? And all I can say, it was not disappointing whatsoever. But you take it where you left over the Rockefellers, and you go through most of the global institutions and the extent to which international institutions and international agreements are being used to just layer over and subvert sovereign law, whether it be sovereign nations or sovereign individuals. Just, you know, this incredible top-down control coming with a tsunami of rules. So how come you took it to the next, you went through the next one with global coup? Tell us about that.
Yeah, the thing was, I was finished with the Rockefeller story, and I had this last chapter that was a lot about the World Economic Forum and their idea of the fourth industrial revolution.
Right.
And I wanted to get this book out. I published it in English, and I was supposed to go on a kind of tour through Europe and promote the book. And I got to Turku in Finland.
Mm-hmm.
And got home, and then came the pandemic.
Right.
So I couldn't do the tour, the promoting, anything. But this thing with the pandemic, a declaration, it told me something. And I understood quite early that this is kind of a triggering event. This is the way to implement this grand plan.
Right.
For the planet.
Right.
So I wrote a couple of articles during the spring. And later that year, I just thought that I have to make a book out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought it was so important that this information got out and that people could navigate in this, because I had all this background material in the Rockefeller book. So it was very easy for me to just know where to look for answers and why this happened. So I worked very fast. We decided this was coming out, but I started to try to get money for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took 3 months from September to December, and the book was out in
So one of my favorite parts, there are many favorite parts, but one of my favorite parts, I just have to hold it up, is Appendix C, where you go through, you know, and you go through the UN Sustainable Development Goals one by one, and you list out the Sustainable Development Goals, and then you show how the World Economic Forum is coming up with a group of solutions to use that umbrella to control.
Yeah.
And you go through each one. Here's the, you know, here's the spin, because they all sound wonderful. End poverty. Who's against that? No, you know, we all want to end poverty. But then you come up with, okay, here's the goal, and then here's what's really going to happen. And it's all about, you know, central control. And it's marvelous the way it's laid out, because it leaves no doubt in your mind what's really going on. So,
yeah. And when I wrote this, because this, the thing is, I wrote this appendix before the pandemic was declared. The first, one of the first articles I wrote in 2020 was about the World Economic Forum meeting.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And to this meeting, they released a report about how the new technologies would solve the Sustainable Development Goals. And I read this, and it was just, are we totally out of our mind? It was stupid, everything. And after this, I mean, that was just, okay, we could use these things. And uh-huh. And after the pandemic was declared, they suddenly used these things.
So it's amazing, because when I used to work in Washington, when there was the name of an act, they would pass an act saying the Community Development Act, we would invert the name and destroying the Communities Act, you know, so to know what the act was about, we would simply invert the name.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, okay, so let's start. We're looking at a syndicate. I'll start with the Rockefeller Syndicate, but it really goes into all these other organizations. They are weaponizing energy, they are weaponizing medicine, and they are weaponizing the environment. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, that's what's written all about it when I've studied this material. Of course, they have.
So I'm assuming the reason they chose carbon was it was a way to measure energy and material use. So if you're looking to own and control all resources, it's a way to measure resource use. And that's why they picked on carbon. But so that's an interest in controlling energy and resources. At the same time, to do that, I'm assuming they chose the climate because they're trying to tap into people's love for the planet and the environment.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. And the thing is, one other aspect, I mean, carbon is life.
Right.
They want to control life.
Right.
That's what's it all about.
Right.
And yeah.
It's hard to explain to most people the craving they have for control. It's quite, it's quite extraordinary. And you know, when you've lived with it and worked with it and been around it, it's easy to understand. But I think it's hard for people to fathom the intensity of their desire for control down to the last atom on the planet.
Yeah.
So they evolved using climate change and using carbon over many decades. What do you think finally got them to realize that this was the way they could get control along with medicine and health?
Yeah, this plan started so early. So they wrote this report, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Special Studies Project.
Mm-hmm.
And in that report, it was I think it was published like in 1961, but the report was written in the late 50s. And in that report, they said that the environment or meteorology, oceanography science. That was a way to more or less control the world and to achieve what they wanted with an international governance system. Because science has always been about, I mean, it's problems that span, I mean, the oceans and the climate is problems that spans across the borders.
Right.
So that was why they decided.
Oh, so they wanted something that everybody related to and everybody touched. It was completely global and common to everybody.
And it's the global commons.
Yeah, and also 2/3 of the population globally, I think, live on rivers or oceans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they, I mean, they have always been into global problems, not local problems.
Right.
Global big problems that they can solve.
Okay, so they've always wanted a one world government. They've always wanted a global government. If you look at the global government they're planning, they're planning on complete totalitarian control. I mean, they're really talking about slavery. So one world government is different than global slavery. So when did the slavery impulse come about? Although they've always practiced slave labor.
I don't know if you can say when it started. I mean, I think it's always been there. You have always had that dimension in it,
right?
Yeah. So I haven't found the day when they decided on that.
Right.
It's just a craving for power, and I think this is very old. I think it's very, very old. This ambition to want to control life itself and every human on the planet.
Right.
And they have worked very hard with developing science in order to achieve this.
Yeah. So it's funny, you know, people always think of the Rockefellers of having come out of the oil industry. But I think their claim to fame was understanding how to build and create and hold together monopolies.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Right. I mean, the Standard Oil was, it was one of the first or the first truly multinational corporation.
Right, right.
But and every multinational corporation is kind of built on afterwards. So it started.
Right. With, right. It was a very, very, financially, it was a very successful model.
Yeah.
So clearly, you know, before the pandemic, there was every effort to try and turn climate change into a major global hysteria that kept falling flat. You know, it was almost like the climate change marketing wasn't going. It stalled. And the global vaccine programs had stalled because science wasn't supporting them. And so then we have the pandemic, and I've watched them try and create these kinds of global pandemics many times before. This is the first time they got it to go global. And so it looks to me from a marketing standpoint that the environment, that climate change was falling flat. And so you needed to go to something that was a lot more fearful, enter the COVID-19.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah, because the climate narrative, I mean, if you ask a lot of people, a lot of them be asked, why? I'm not afraid of the climate. You can do a lot with young people and propaganda and indoctrination for a while, but when you get experienced, you realize that this doesn't hold up.
Well, it's very funny because there's been a lot of back and forth about efficiency of different energy types. One of the Democratic senators, just pulled the plug on Biden's green and climate change proposals in his quote Build Back Better, and he's from West Virginia. And the problem is, the people in West Virginia watching the solar material all go into landfills and, you know, be highly environmentally destructive and less efficient. So the economics don't work, the efficiency doesn't work, and the environmental impact doesn't work. It's like, well, why are we doing this? Or if you've ever run through the, you know, there's a wonderful ally of Michael Moore made a great video on sort of renewable energy and did all the biomass.
Yeah.
And I just went through Ripka Selmaker's article on the biomass plant. Yeah. And the economics are so destructive of the environment. You know, there's nothing sensible or positive or practical. And I just think there are way too many people in the energy business who understand this doesn't make economic or environmental sense.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
So people that know about energy, they understand this. Right. And that's why I think they have decided to get rid of the people that know things. So you get, in a way, we have young women that are put in these positions but have no experience of it. But they are women and they can say now, we are doing this to get with equality. And we, the old men must go and their crazy ideas and...
So I just have to tell you,
because they know things.
I just have to tell you a funny story I've told on the Salier Report before, but I was during the financial crisis. I used to be an investment advisor and I had a new client who had a bond fund. She had a high yield bond fund from a socially responsible investment manager. So all these companies have master prospectus where all their fund is in one master prospectus. So I went in to read the prospectus on the high yield fund, and right next to it was an equity fund that specialized in only investing in companies that were great for women. And I looked at it, and the top 10 holdings, if you had asked me, Jacob, to make a list of the 10 companies who are the most destructive to women and their families in the world, it would have been those 10 companies. Yeah. So I opened it up and I went in and I realized, oh, the criteria is that they hire women from Harvard Business School. That's the criteria. That's good for women. So you can destroy women. You can destroy their livelihoods. You can foreclose and destroy their communities. But as long as you hire 50 women from Harvard Business School, you're good for women.
Yeah, exactly. And you know the report I was referring to with this sustainable development goals,
right?
From the appendix. I mean, that report was written by I think six of seven authors were women,
right?
So they put them in charge to create this dystopian nightmare.
What happened, and you document this very well, what happened is with all the international organizations, starting with the UN and the Sustainable Development Goals, but, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, what they started to do was create many new jurisdictions, and within those jurisdictions, an unbelievable, I just call it a tsunami of new rules. So if you're a citizen anywhere in the world and you say, okay, what's my municipality? What's my provincial area? What's my national government? What international area am I in with all these agreements that I'm subject to? You could spend the rest of your life learning the terms and conditions of all the laws and regulations that you're subject to. And so they literally built technocracy with a tsunami of rules. And it started with cybernetics, which you touch on in the book. Maybe if you could talk a little bit of cybernetics and mind control and how technocracy evolved from these.
Yeah, cybernetics was a discipline that was created by Norbert Wiener, I think in 1948. And it's the science of communication and control, and it's more or less to create systems, systems for where people get connected to more or less the machine, and it's used for predictability and to in order to steer things in a perfect order. And cybernetics was a big thing in the Soviet Union as well, because they wanted to create this perfect system and I mean to get people to think correctly. And I think I mean when you have all a lot of systems thinkers that are involved in these cybernetics programs that evolved after the 1948. And it's of course very connected to the idea of technocracy. And that of course is a bit earlier. It's from the early 30s that Technocracy Inc. was created at the Columbia University. Right. Patrick Wood is a big expert in
so we've had Patrick on our on our show several times, and love Patrick and everything he's doing. And one of the most exciting things I saw was you're hooked up big time with Patrick, and the two of you are really swarming together. And I see that as being a wonderful, I think that's a life-changing partnership there.
the thing is, Patrick, he worked with Anthony Sutton.
So he really understands how change occurs.
Yeah, and Anthony Sutton is I mean, he was brilliant. And I really like him as a researcher. He is such a role model for me.
So I was just
teaming up with Patrick, but I mean, he worked with me. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. I was just giving a copy of Sutton's Wall Street trilogy to a young man this weekend, trying to explain to him why he needed to read Sutton to kind of understand how the economy really works. Anyway, okay, so where do you believe the global coup is going? What do you think they want to achieve?
I mean, in the end, they want this, they have this idea of a perfect system that comes from the idea of cybernetics and systems theory. Where every people will be connected to more or less,
a machine,
artificial intelligence,
right?
And also a social credit system, in order to make the world totally in balance, in their perspective,
right?
It's a way of playing God. Be like God, judging like God,
right?
And I refer it to as the false temple. I actually have. You mentioned that I'm a musician as well, and I'm doing. I'm creating music, and I have. I've written these books, but I have also a music project that will be a book, and that is. About the Temple of Solomon. It's called Temple of Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I go back a very long time since the Elizabethan age and Dr. John Dee in England and his ideas of creating a world empire and how they had ideas of perfect the world that God had left undone with the use of science. So this has been a part of a parallel project I have. I've written music and songs about these topics. And this,
yeah, you have music about the Georgia Guidestone.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was interesting as well, because, I mean, what happened with Georgia Guidestones, was it 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Very, very strange. Yeah.
That was strange.
Yeah.
So let me argue on their defense. What they would say is if you use you know, we tried sovereign governments with democratic process and markets. And the pricing of markets and then the pricing of the political system with campaigns. But that didn't work. And it didn't work for two reasons. One is that people tend to vote for whoever gives them money in the short term. So they won't risk manage long term. Now, I don't agree with that, but that's what they would argue. The other thing is you have no idea who's going to end up in control. In a meritocracy, who knows what could happen? It could get wild. And they would argue it doesn't provide for sufficient long-term risk management, particularly when so much of our world is secret. So for markets to work, you need to turn the lights on and you can't have all the secrecy. And you need to be able to trust the general population to do good long-term risk management. You can't trust them to do it. That's what they would argue.
Yeah. And they also want to have this idea of more or less controlling the future.
Right.
So, so I mean, of course, they think we do good things because they can have pre-crisis management instead of post-crisis management.
Right.
So they can do a better world because they know what will happen. And right. With this technology and to be able to know what everyone in the society thinks and do, they can get rid of risks and right. create a more stable society.
So a lot of this is about risk management, but risk management to ensure that they remain in control.
Yeah.
And risk management to make sure that the different... You know, it's very frustrating if you're managing a society and you decide, okay, we're going to go to the right. And then you position all the transactions to go to the right. And then suddenly a group of people just come on and want to go to the left. And it makes a huge mess financially with how you've positioned the money. So part of it is, you know, when I get back to secrecy, the more the money is managed on a secret basis secretly, the harder the challenge gets of doing the risk management. And it's, you know, think of this as almost a spiral down in secrecy. Okay, we'll just, you know, we'll just have AI and the machine do everything and somehow that's going to work. I'm laughing my head off because I just read a letter. I've had a running battle for 5 years over whether or not you can trust the technology of the blockchain and systems built on blockchain. And some group of technologists who have much more impressive credentials than I do wrote, 1,600 of them wrote a letter to Congress that said, this is a totally, you can't trust this technology whatsoever. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's and, you know, and they were from, you know, a couple of them were from Google, Eric Schmidt's company, and he's the master of thinking this is all going to work. Okay. So clearly they expect the UN, did they expect the UN to evolve into a world government, or did they just expect to use the SDGs through the UN to evolve? I mean, they're certainly using the WHO to try and force us into world government.
Yeah, the thing is, actually now I'm writing a new article series about our common agenda, United Nations, our common agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this as an answer on this when they talked about the Great Reset, World Economic Forum, and Antonio Guterres from United Nations. And this is kind of the answer. So I have been working on an article series about, because they describe in this document that came out in September last year, 12 commitments to more or less upgrade the United Nations to a new structure.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's very interesting because there they have all these ideas and you can see how it connects to this, I would say, an idea to create a world brain.
Right.
Yeah. A perfect technological connected society governed by more or less artificial intelligence.
Right.
All in this.
Who's developing this proposal?
What did you say?
Who's developing the proposal?
The proposal came from Antonio Guterres because, of course, it's not he that has written it. But I have gone through every commitment now, and you can find that a lot of this comes from the working groups of the World Economic Forum, because United Nations and World Economic Forum have been in a partnership since 2019, in order to solve and these sustainable development goals.
Somebody sent around a cute meme. I don't know if you see it. It's a little girl with chalk writing on the wall. And somebody's written the Great Reset, and she's crossed out reset and written resist, the Great Resist.
Yeah, I've seen it.
And then there's a picture of Schwab, and it says, it's 2030, you own nobody, and you are unhappy. Okay, so I want to talk for a second about money and the BIS.
Yeah.
If you go through a lot of the work at Solari, particularly writings that John Titus has done with us for the last 2 years, we're very focused on the money. And one of the reasons these guys can write and promote a tsunami of rules is because they can print an infinite amount of money to implement rules that make no economic sense whatsoever. So if I want to come into a community and make everybody run it according to a social credit system, which is very unproductive and wasteful, I can make it work as long as I can permit, you know, print more money, which is actually what's happening in the United States. They're destroying productivity by printing, you know, money and paying people to do things that are unproductive. And so you can get these systems that economically really dramatically spiral down. So the contracting in the federal government in the United States is a perfect example, because they just spend more and more money. And part of 9/11 was busting through and making sure they could continue to print for phenomenally unproductive things, you know, not to mention wars, which are great forms of, you know, giving you an excuse to print money and then send it, you know, send it to your pals under the guise of you're sending them missiles or something. Anyway, but so a lot of what made this system go was the money part. And you tend not to get into that. Whereas if you come to Solari, that's about all we talk about.
Yes.
And that's why I love your work, because if you take your work and our work and you put it together, it's like you see both sides of that. You're on one side of the balance sheet. We're on the other side of the balance sheet. And in fact, if you want to understand the game, you've got to understand both sides of the balance sheet.
Of course. Yeah.
Right. So I find this to be a very valuable conversation and research, because it really helps me see how it fits in. And I don't think the financial people have any idea how phenomenally powerful and controlling all these rules are, you know, and the regulatory side of things for controlling. Have you thought about integrating the sort of what the BIS and the central banks are up to and how it relates? Because remember, they're creating a set of rules while the central banking gives system and the related enforcement gives them the ability to be above the law. So you have an insiders-outsiders games, and the rules apply to, you know, making the outsiders do what you want, or getting you, you know, making it possible for you to take the farmer's land, but you don't have to follow them. So here in Europe, we see, you know, the green aviation tax doesn't apply to corporate jets. And yachts are excluded. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's an insider's outside game. And the tsunami of rules relates to helping the insiders take what they want or make the outsiders do what they want. And I like to, you know, they're running into trouble now. I should mention this. They're running into trouble because people are beginning to realize, oh, there's a double standard.
Yeah, they do.
Right.
Yeah. And I think one thing, I mean, you said that I have my perspective and you at Solari have your perspective, and we put it together and we understand the picture more because Because I'm not that I don't understand the, all the economics, but so I need someone like you that understands.
Right.
And Patrick Wood that has his side.
See, Patrick came out of the financial. He's got a great financial background.
Yeah.
And one of his powers is he's really good at integrating both sides.
Yeah.
So and Sutton was too.
Yeah.
You know, Sutton understood the money stuff, but he organized his approach around who's doing what.
Yeah.
That's what I like about your work, because
That's what I've learned from Sutton.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to look at who. You can't just look at what, you have to look at who. And so anyway, so we're in cahoots and we're merging. Okay. So talk to us about what can we do. So we see this. Oh, before I get to that, I just want to tell you one thing. You had a piece in the Global Coup Appendix, you know, the World Economic Forum comparison with the SDGs. That was worth the price of 10 books right there. But the other thing was, you had a letter that had come from an Iowa chapter and had been proposed for the 92 Earth Charter. I don't even know if you remember it. It's buried in the appendix. And what it proposes is, through the UN, that the world should give every country a quota to manage depopulation.
Yes, I know. It's not an appendix. It's in the first chapter, actually.
Oh, is it? You had the full letter. It was in the appendix.
Yeah,
again.
Yeah, maybe the full letter was in the appendix. Yeah,
the full letter was in the appendix.
Because I mentioned it in the beginning. Yeah,
and
that was a very, very shocking document. And that was a proposal by a little group that had a pre-meeting for the Rio conference.
Right. But if you look at what they described, the quota system and how it would be enforced,
yeah,
it describes exactly what we're experiencing right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's exactly what we're experiencing. And what was interesting is, I don't know if you know, the guy who led the effort to build the Georgia Guidestones apparently came from Iowa.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was connected. Anyway, but he described, I found that letter to be phenomenally valuable because it describes exactly what we're experiencing.
Yeah.
Because every country has a different, clearly they have a slightly different quota.
Hmm.
It's not the same in different places. Anyway, okay, what can we do? We're watching these folks literally put into place rules and financial structures and surveillance and technology to try and literally control the world down to the atomic, subatomic level. What do we do?
Watch us, they fail. Because one thing, I mean, this is hubris. They think they can actually control everything. And I mean, every move they do now is just, it's just so stupid. And more people understand how much they try now to put in all these misinformation, disinformation, everything. They do every effort they can to just try to get us not understand the real picture. But I sense that they are failing and it's going much faster now. And I think in my experience, I mean, I started with when I wrote my PhD, doctoral thesis. I was kind of very alone at my university, and it was very few people that actually understood.
Right.
This. But not nowadays. I get calls every day. It's so many people that talk to me about. And also internationally.
Yeah.
So things are happening, and it's happening fast. And I would say that it's them. It's those people that think they can control us. Their time is running out.
So one of the things that helps them is memory wipe. You know, people forget where this came from, how it developed, who did it, what happened. And that's why I want everyone to know how to get a copy of your book. I was bragging about the Rockefeller book and I got a complaint. Somebody said, I can't find how to buy it because they probably went to the wrong place to buy it. So all the big stores. How can we find, when will Global Coup be available in English?
It is translated and we just have to print it. And we also are going to do an ebook.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. So if we go to your website, we can we can order the Rockefeller book. Can we pre-order Global Coup yet?
I will make sure that you can do that within a few days.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, this will publish in the first week of August.
Yeah. Then so we'll have it on because we are working now with the web, my web page and Foundation's web page to make it more accessible for English speaking people.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, if you want a critical history of a very important piece of Mr. Global, you know, people are always saying, who is Mr. Global? This is a very, very important piece. So I recommend both. If you want a complete library of how the world works, I think both of these are a must have. And I just have to thank you again. You know, your research is you have more patience than I do. But your research is quite phenomenal. And it's this is really something that can break through to people because it's so thorough. It's so complete. It's so well documented. And, you know, it reminds me of that line in Rosemary's Baby when Mia Farrow says, this is really happening.
Yeah, because that's what I wanted to do, to achieve. Because I mean, I saw what the world was heading. And I just want to write a book that no one can say, this is just your fantasies. It's just speculation. No, this is fact. I have
right.
Yeah, I've been very thorough to find
it. Yeah, you have. Mm. Okay, so before we close, any final thoughts that you want to communicate from, you know, you've had quite an experience documenting and writing all this. Any final thoughts you want our audience to know?
I think I've said what I wanted, I always want to give this positive view of the future, because I think we have something very special that these machine type people don't have. We have this heart and we are humans and we have all this inside us, but machines can't beat us. It's just
look. Right.
So we shouldn't be that afraid.
Yeah, so machines should make our life easier, not tell us what to do.
Exactly. I mean, we can talk through the screen, but...
I keep bringing this up. One of my favorite movies is called The Neverending Story. It's from a German fairy tale. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So the protagonist is fighting the nothing. And that's part of what we're dealing with is the nothing. Okay, well, Jakob, I also have to mention you have a fantastic wife, and I want you to thank her for me because I know.
And she's a big help.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the most fantastic thing as well, because I was alone working for myself, and I just wanted someone that understood me.
Uh-huh.
And then I found her. And
yeah.
And I think that's the thing with real partnerships.
Yeah.
And a woman. And actually, you create something bigger than you can do yourself. And we are that perfect match. So,
yeah.
So she's helping me with everything, with the books, and has made them much better than I could do myself.
Yeah,
so I'm
it's
very
true.
For her work.
Where one of my favorite scriptures are two, if where two or more are gathered, there am I. Okay. Jakob, have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us on the Solera Report. We're in cahoots. Give my best to Patrick and let us know how we can be of assistance and support you.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure. And I'm very happy that we are in contact now.
Yeah. As we always say at Solera, we want to go back to Stockholm. You have a wonderful day.
Yeah. The same.